Imagine a society where the absolute pinnacle of leadership, the king, has just, well, vanished without a trace.
Right, just completely gone.
Yeah, and the political factions left behind are instantly at each other's throats.
Oh, absolutely.
And, survival in this world relies just as much on spotting a clever illusion as it does on, like, swinging a sharp sword.
Because you're dealing with a world that is not only politically fracturing, but environmentally collapsing too.
Yeah, that.
The entire realm is buckling under this unnatural, unseasonably long winter. I mean, the literal ecosystem has turned against its inhabitants.
Just crushing them under endless snow. Welcome to today's deep dive. We are transporting you directly into the high fantasy realm of Mirari.
It is a wild ride.
It really is. We've got a fascinating stack of sources today that track three interconnected journeys happening simultaneously in this freezing, fractured world.
Right.
We're going to track the high-stakes political maneuvering of Mirari's magical houses, the chaotic dangers of the wild, and how these characters navigate a landscape where reality itself just cannot be trusted.
And I think it's important to note for you listening, while Mirari is, on the surface, a world of sorceresses and tree men.
Which is awesome, by the way.
Oh, totally awesome. But the core mechanics of what these characters are experiencing, they are deeply grounded in reality.
All right.
You are watching individuals navigate severe information overload, total systemic breakdown, and this desperate struggle to find actual truth amidst layers of, institutional deception.
Which feels very relevant right now.
Exactly. It's a fantasy setting,
Yeah.
but the strategies these characters use to survive, they're incredibly relevant to how you have to process the modern world today.
So let's just drop right into the political deep freeze. Our first source follows a character named Tom,
Right.
and he's traveling with his companions, Simon and Eleanor, who also goes by Rachel.
Yeah.
They've just arrived in the city via a carriage drawn by actual massive
Which
wolves.
is such a terrifying little luxury.
I know, right? And it's provided by a powerful figure named Lord December. So they arrive at their destination, a place called the Mews.
And visually, the Muse is this brilliant sensory contradiction. It serves as the headquarters for the Golden Hawks.
The elite scouts.
Right, this elite order of explorers.
Yes.
But physically, it's
Yeah.
essentially a massive renovated stable.
Yeah.
So you have the distinct earthy smell of horse sweat, damp hay, and oiled leather mixing with that freezing air outside.
But then inside.
Inside the living quarters, it's lined with rich Persian carpets, heavy woven tapestries to block the drafts, roaring fireplaces.
It's like purely practical, but intensely comfortable.
Exactly, especially against the backdrop of an endless winter.
So inside, they meet an old ally, Minstrel Sam, and Sam just drops this massive lore bomb about the current state of Mirari.
The political situation is a mess.
It really is. According to Sam, the factions of Spring and Autumn are locked in this vicious Cold War. There's a massive succession crisis over whether Lord April or Lord October should be the rightful heir to the throne.
And the justification for this stalemate is fascinating. People are just clinging to an ancient prophecy.
Right, Sam quotes it directly.
Yeah, he says, "Neither October nor April shall rule or the other unto the 50th generation."
Which, I mean, is the ultimate bureaucratic excuse to do absolutely nothing.
Totally.
The king is missing, and the rules dictate that no one has ever passed the succession without a king present to oversee it.
Right.
On top of that, the Lord Protector, who is basically the ultimate guardian figure of the realm, is trapped somewhere in a shadowy realm of darkness.
It's a total leadership void.
It's like a massive corporate inheritance feud breaking out.
Yes.
The company's CEO is missing, the building's heating system is completely broken, and everyone in the cubicles is freezing to death.
Right, but the board of directors is entirely focused on squabbling over the corporate bylaws instead of fixing the existential threat. They're prioritizing the procedural rules of the system over the actual survival of the system. You
Exactly.
see this in failing institutions all the time. When the macro problem like this endless winter is too terrifying or complex to solve, leadership just retreats into procedural paralysis.
They just argue about who gets to sit in the big chair.
Because it's a problem they feel they can actually manage.
Which absolutely drives Tom crazy. He refuses to get dragged into the boardroom politics. He needs to get to the root cause.
Right.
But Tom has a problem. He's been trapped in a mortal realm for 14 years. And his memories of Mirari are heavily fragmented.
So he needs to jog his memory.
Yeah. He heads to the house of Lord November, claiming to be the reincarnated or returned Lord Explorer Thomas.
and the visual details of November's house just leap off the page.
Oh, it was incredible.
The architecture perfectly mirrors the whole theme of deception. From a distance, the estate looks like a perfectly natural autumnal grove.
Yeah.
You have these massive trees bent to form the frame of the house, with branches intricately folded so dense layers of red, orange, and gold leaves create the walls.
It looks so fragile and organic.
But as Tom gets up close, the illusion breaks. Those beautiful autumn leaves are just flawless camouflage for a plain, impenetrable, solid stone.
And they walk up to this camouflaged fortress and are greeted by a literal tree butler.
I love the tree butler.
It's not just a guy in a green suit. He has rigid, bark-like skin, mossy green hair, wears an impeccable butler's uniform.
And every time he bows,
you hear this deep, woody creak. Like a ship's hull settling in the water. It's such a great detail.
It really is.
But once they actually get an audience with Lord November, the reception is incredibly frosty.
November is highly skeptical that Tom is who he says he is.
Right.
He points out that shapeshifters are incredibly common in Mirari, and looking exactly like the old Lord Thomas doesn't mean you actually hold his soul or his skills.
November's paranoia is a direct symptom of that systemic breakdown we talked about earlier. Completely. In a world where reality is fluid and the central authority has vanished, the baseline for societal trust just evaporates.
Taking someone at face value is a quick way to get yourself killed.
Exactly. Especially someone claiming a powerful historical title.
So Tom realizes he can't just talk his way into November's good graces. He reveals a piece of information that completely changes the dynamic.
Right.
Tom says he knows the king wasn't kidnapped. He says he looked into the king's eyes before he vanished and saw profound, tangible pain.
Yeah.
Tom suspects a massive, devastating betrayal forced the king to willingly abandon his own kingdom.
And by diagnosing the root cause of the king's absence, Tom proves he isn't just another political opportunist.
He's looking at the systemic rot.
Exactly.
But wait, I have to push back here for a second.
Sure.
If the Lord Protector is supposed to be this ultimate god-tier guardian of the realm, how does a betrayal happen right under his nose?
That's a great question.
How does the king get hurt so badly that he flees his own home? And furthermore, isn't Lord November just using Tom's arrival to run a personal errand under the guise of a grand test of his identity?
Well, you're hitting on the exact limitations of physical power. The text heavily implies that the betrayal the king suffered wasn't an assassination attempt or, like, an invading army.
Right.
It was uniquely intimate. An emotional or psychological knife in the back, a physical Lord Protector with a shield and a sword, cannot block a broken heart or a shattered alliance.
Oh, wow.
The defenses were looking outward, but the rot came from within.
That makes a lot of sense.
And regarding Lord November, yes, he is absolutely exploiting Tom.
Yeah, I thought so.
He tells Tom that to prove he is the legendary finder of the Golden Hawks, he must locate November's own daughter, Hannah,
who vanished a full year ago near the highly dangerous Hawksmoor Keep.
Right. He even gives Tom his personal signet ring to show Hannah as proof of his mission, assuming she's even still alive.
It's a ruthless but brilliant calculation on November's part.
Trust, in Mirari right now, is a currency that can only be minted through physical action.
Not claimed by a title.
Exactly. November synthesizes his personal desperation as a father with his political caution as a lord.
If Tom is a shape-shifting fraud, he will simply die in the freezing wilds.
And if he is truly the Lord Explorer, November gets his daughter back.
Yeah.
It's a brutal audit of Tom's competence.
So while Tom is forced out into the deadly wilderness just to prove his identity to the old guard, there are other characters in Mirari who are actively refusing to play these political games at all.
Right.
We shift our focus over to the Hall of the Lake.
And the environmental storytelling here provides such a stark contrast to November's cozy, camouflaged stone house.
Oh, yeah. Totally different vibe.
The Hall of the Lake is this vast chamber constructed entirely of white marble streaked with veins of deep green.
Lit by this cold, sourceless, magical glow.
It is undeniably beautiful, but it is sterile, isolating, and highly intimidating.
It's here that the Lady Sorceress Nimue is hosting two young women, Agatha and Alice.
And the quiet tension in this marble room just shatters when uninvited guests arrive.
Captain Morgan.
Captain Morgan represents House October. And she is an incredibly intimidating figure. A fierce woman with a literal rack of sharp antlers growing from her head.
And she doesn't come alone.
No, she brings a heavily armed contingent. She's flanked by four roos,
which are the large, imposing deer centaurs.
Right. and towering, hulking tree men. It is a blatant, overwhelming show of force masked as a polite diplomatic visit.
Morgan is there to formally invite Nimue and her two mortal guests to Lord October's lands.
You can just feel the social chess match happening in real time.
Yeah. Nimue flat out declines the invitation. She knows Lord October just wants to use her as a political pawn in his stalemate against Lord April.
But Agatha and Alice make a surprising move.
They decide to accept the invitation.
Not because they trust this antlered captain, obviously.
Right. But because they are flying blind in this world and desperately need to gather intelligence on the political landscape.
Nimue recognizes the extreme danger of walking into an enemy camp. Before Agatha and Alice depart, she secretly gives them both small amulets bearing the symbol of a leaping heart.
Like a magical emergency beacon.
Exactly. She instructs them to hold the amulet and speak her name three times if they find themselves in mortal danger.
And they are going to need that beacon almost immediately.
Yeah, things go bad fast.
Because en route to October's lands, the terrifying visceral reality of Mirari's wild spaces violently interrupt their diplomatic posturing. The carriage is ambushed.
The speed at which order completely breaks down here is staggering.
It's chaos.
Captain Morgan is riding a night steed. Now, this is a highly trained magical horse historically known for being completely unflappable in combat.
Right.
But the very second this ambush begins, this legendary steed starts violently shivering, snorting, and completely loses its mind in panic.
Because the attackers aren't standard fantasy goblins or bandits, they are being swarmed by bugbears.
The bugbear.
The sources describe them as massive, hulking, shaggy monsters, but with horrifying insectoid features.
Yeah, they have multifaceted, bulging insect eyes.
And long, dark, clicking mandibles gleaming in the winter sunlight. They are a visual nightmare.
But worse than how they look is what they project.
Right.
An aura of pure, unreasoning, magical panic.
That panic aura is their primary weapon, and it completely bypasses the brain to attack the nervous system.
It literally paralyzes the deer centaurs.
Yeah. Even Caradoc, the normally brave Foruv that Agatha is riding, is too physically terrified to take a single step forward.
The highly trained magical creatures are entirely neutralized by this psychological assault.
But Agatha, a mortal human, manages to push through the dread.
Yeah.
She sees a lone swordsman named Treherne desperately defending his fallen lord, Orne of September, in the snow. Agatha charges in with her sword.
And in the chaos, she discovers a crucial mechanical flaw in the monsters.
She swings at a bugbear's knee, expecting it to block her blade. Instead, the massive monster flinches violently away from the metal.
She realizes they have a fatal weakness. These magical horrors are absolutely terrified of and easily wounded by iron.
She drives her iron blade right into its leg and the monster goes down screaming.
We really have to look at the mechanics of why iron works here.
Okay, yeah.
In classic folklore and in the rules of Mirari, iron acts as a grounding rod. Magic, especially complex projection magic like a panic aura or glamoury, requires a fluid, conductive medium to travel.
Oh, interesting.
Cold, mundane iron disrupts that frequency. It absorbs and neutralizes the magical charge.
So Agatha's raw physical courage combined with a basic elemental metal cuts right through the complex magical terror.
Exactly.
And once the monsters are finally routed, we get this incredible, almost absurd sequence with Alice.
Oh, this part is brilliant.
The battlefield is a mess. Orin, the fallen lord, is unconscious, bleeding deeply from a head wound, his lips turning blue from the freezing snow.
Right.
One of Morrigan's tree men, Adair, steps forward and gravely suggests applying Angelica root to magically draw out the injury.
But Alice steps right past him.
Yes. She pulls out her canvas bag, and instead of mystical herbs, she pulls out modern terrestrial first aid.
You're watching a total clash of paradigms here.
She brings out bottles of chemical antiseptics, sterile cotton balls, a fresh roll of bandages.
Yes.
She even takes a regular cloth napkin that previously held her travel cookies, packs it tight with clean snow, and applies it as a modern ice pack to reduce the swelling on Orin's head.
It's so practical.
And then, when the swordsman Treherne reveals he has four deep, filthy claw gashes down his arm, Alice asks the bewildered tree man to boil some water over a fire.
Right.
She cools it with fresh snow and literally sanitizes the dirty wounds with modern antiseptic before binding them tightly.
And the tree men are just completely baffled by the sharp chemical smell of the antiseptic.
It is completely out of context for a world of sorcery and Angelica root.
But It is brutally, undeniably effective.
It is so funny to read. It's like bringing a plastic first aid kit and a tube of Neosporin to a medieval jousting tournament.
Yeah.
But the juxtaposition is what makes it brilliant. On one hand, you have the height of high fantasy.
Right, like after the battle, Orin's panicked night steed actually approaches him, bows his head in shame.
And apologizes by gently offering Orin a sugar cube from his own mouth.
It's such a magical moment.
And right next to that, you have Alice relying on the cold, hard logic of microbial sanitation and iron blades.
It proves a central thesis of survival in Mirari. Practical, systematic knowledge grounded in physical reality will reliably triumph over magical posturing.
When the complex systems fail, Agatha and Alice survive because they rely on the tangible, not the mystical.
Which brings us perfectly to a character who is embodying that thesis entirely on her own.
Yes, we finally catch up with Hannah.
Lord November's missing daughter.
The exact person Tom was sent into the frozen wilds to find. She is completely alone, deep in the Golden Woods near Hawksmoor Keep.
And the Golden Woods are historically described as awe-inspiring. Massive, ancient trees with shimmering golden bark, growing 20 times the height of a normal man.
But not anymore.
No, the endless winter has completely choked the life out of them. The massive branches are splintering and crashing down under the heavy, unnatural snow.
The paths are obscured by thick, shadowy, icy vines.
The atmosphere isn't magical anymore. It's intensely oppressive and claustrophobic.
So Hannah is just trying to navigate this freezing nightmare. She's incredibly pragmatic, though.
Very.
She uses the tip of her rapier to scratch a small hidden arrow into the base of a tree, physically marking her path so she doesn't walk in circles.
Smart.
But as she's moving, she hears someone heavily kicking up snow and whistling a tune. She immediately hides her lantern light under her heavy cloak.
And through the trees, she spots the threat. It's a kobold bandit.
But with the distinct twitching head of a massive rat.
Yeah. And the scene is incredibly eerie because he's acting so casually.
Right.
He's dragging a wooden keg through the snow, pouring dark rum into a pewter mug, and cheerfully singing, "Eluding we go, eluding we go."
It's terrifying, but also wonderfully absurd. Now, Hannah is smart enough to know she cannot outmuscle a monster in the snow, so she decides to fight magic with magic.
She relies on glamoury.
Right, illusion magic. She focuses all her mental energy and projects a massive visual image directly over her own body.
So when the rat-headed kobold turns around, he doesn't see a freezing, exhausted young woman.
No, he looks up and sees a massive, muscular, terrifying giantess wielding a huge club.
The kobold literally drops his mug of rum in the snow and runs screaming into the trees.
It's a brilliant, tactical use of deception.
She leverages the fluid reality of Mirari to her advantage. Glamoury requires immense focus to project a false reality into someone else's mind.
Yeah.
But this immediate success sets up the central thematic conflict of the entire deep dive.
Right.
Hannah uses an illusion to save her own life, but mere moments later, an illusion almost ends it.
The path she is following through the dark woods suddenly forks. Both the left path and the right path look completely identical in the gloom.
But this contradicts her memory of the woods.
Yeah, she knows there shouldn't be a fork here. She holds her lantern out, casting light down both paths, but her eyes cannot discern a single difference between them.
This is the climax of her journey. She is paralyzed by conflicting information.
But then she remembers a critical piece of advice from her old tutor.
A prim, bark-skinned man who understood the mechanics of the world.
Yeah, he told her that illusions in Mirari are designed to easily fool the eye, but they can rarely fool the hand.
The visual projection is flawless, but it lacks physical substance.
So Hannah refuses to just trust what she sees. She physically steps to the edge of the left path, kneels down in the snow, pulls off her glove, and reaches her bare hand out to touch the flat dirt.
And immediately, her hand scrapes against an invisible, jagged rock.
Her eyes are telling her brain that there is a flat, safe dirt path, but her tactile sense of touch tells her there is a solid, dangerous obstacle.
She actively verifies her reality through physical friction.
She trusts her hand over her eyes. She backs away from the illusion and takes the right path instead.
And the source material notes that if she had taken that left path, she would have stepped directly off a hidden cliff and plummeted into a deadly, unseen gorge.
Which is terrifying.
It is. But look at the macro level of Mirari. The overarching systems are entirely broken.
Yeah, the king has vanished.
The political factions are deadlocked in a corporate-style feud. Even the foundational planetary system of time and nature, the changing of the seasons, is broken, trapped in an endless winter.
Right.
When those macro systems fail, the micro environment around you becomes inherently hostile and deceptive.
Yeah.
You literally cannot trust the ground you walk on.
Because the world itself is lying to you.
Precisely. In an environment defined by systemic breakdown, sensory input, what the authorities tell you, what the environment shows you, cannot be passively trusted.
Yeah.
Hannah survives this nightmare, not because she has the sharpest sword or the most powerful magic, but because she demands physical proof.
She touches the dirt.
She refuses to accept the frictionless, easy narrative presented to her eyes.
Let's bring all of this together. We've journeyed through a fantasy world gripped by an existential, seemingly endless winter.
Right.
At the very top of society, the political leaders are completely paralyzed. They are sitting in their camouflaged houses and marble halls, arguing over the procedural rules of succession and ancient prophecies.
Entirely ignoring the dying world right outside their windows.
But down on the ground, in the freezing mud and the snowy woods, individuals are actually finding ways to survive.
And they aren't doing it through grand political strategy.
No. They are surviving by combining the grounding force of old school iron, the undeniable logic of modern first aid and sanitation, and the relentless critical thinking required to see through deadly, beautifully crafted illusions.
They survive because they rely on what is real.
Exactly.
Whether you are navigating a magical freezing forest in Mirari, or your own modern landscape of intense algorithmic information overload, the core lesson translates perfectly.
You have to question the flawless, frictionless illusions presented to you.
You have to rely on your practical tools, your own equivalent of iron swords and chemical antiseptic.
Yeah.
And most importantly, you cannot let high-level systemic chaos distract you from carefully, methodically verifying the immediate path right in front of your feet.
If the political factions of Mirari are manufacturing reality to maintain control in a crisis, what happens when the institutions you rely on in the real world, the ones supposed to be fixing the metaphorical heating system, are the very entities casting the illusions?
It's a heavy thought.
It really is. Think about the narratives you consume every day. What goes into your personal first aid kit to sanitize the truth when the official story is completely fabricated? In your own life, when you are faced with a fork in the road that seems too good to be true, what is your equivalent of reaching out to touch the ground? How do you test the reality of the information you're given before you take that next step?